There is a small but growing world of high-achievement education giving rise to after-school learning centers, spelling bees, and math competitions.
And what we're seeing then is an education arms race that's starting at a younger and younger age.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the trend towards hyper-education. We'll also spend an academic minute with superheroes and race relations. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Can there be too much education, and if so, is it a bad thing? The answer to that question is the thing Dr. Pavan Dhingra is searching for in his book called Hyper-Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Pavan Dhingra is a sociologist and a professor of American Studies at Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts. We spoke about why he took on education in overdrive.
As I've started to meet families who were pursuing education for their kids after school, even though their kids were in fine school districts, I started asking, well, kind of what motivates you for this? And they were really committed to the idea that their kids should not rely on the schools alone to be educating their children. And that even though the kids were in very good schools, well-ranked schools, schools that people would, you know, move to these suburbs or towns just to be inside those school districts, they still did not believe the school systems could be trusted to educate children effectively and efficiently. And what really struck me about this was, you know, if we're talking about, let's say, a high school senior preparing for the SAT, or even, you know, someone in high school looking for help in an AP class, you can understand, well, you know, these are kind of SATs and APs are important for college admissions, and therefore we can understand that practice and that pursuit. But here we're talking about young children, typically in elementary school, who are doing just fine in school. They don't need help catching up to grade level or staying at grade level. And even then, the parents are saying, no, we need more educational training for them, so we're going to seek it out or do it ourselves in very proactive and thoughtful ways.
Is this almost always initiated by the parents, not the students?
I would say, I'm glad you use the word almost always, because that, in that sense, yes. Many times, it's children themselves are very interested in this. And I talk to parents who said, I didn't even know there were these learning opportunities outside of school until my child asked for them. Or they came home and saying, I really like this. Can I do more of this? And so the parents were looking around and trying to find places where the children could do more math. Or parents would say, my kids loved reading and loved spelling. And so getting them into a spelling bee just was like following their interest, not ours. But by and large, parents sought these out for the kids and had enrolled the children in them without necessarily getting, you know, the children to be super excited by them in the first place. So it's not a clear, like, top-down parents are making the kids do this, but you do obviously parents who are putting their kids into activities that the kids may not have chosen or may not even want to be in on their own.
When putting this book together, you obviously spoke to a lot of people. Who did you talk to for this? Who did you seek out?
Primarily, it's parents whose children are involved in these after-school activities, whether those be spelling bees, math competitions, after-school learning centers like Kumon and Mathnasium and Sylvan that are all over the country, as well as public school teachers, because they're the ones who are experiencing these children in their classrooms, and school principals and health experts, as well as college admissions officers, and then also kids themselves, right? I spoke to many children, including those who had gone through these kinds of educational experiences as youth and now were in college, or even after college, and having them reflect back on their experiences. You know, their white families, their immigrant families. A good part of the research took place in the Boston area, but also nationally.
You said you spoke to some college students who have gone through this. Did they say, hey, that really helped me where I am now?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I was waiting for them to say things like this was a waste or I kind of regret. And then you did hear that sometimes. In fact, there was one, a Scripps National Spelling Bee champion. I interviewed more than one past champion, but one who said, you know, I gave a lot of my life to preparing for that National Scripps Championship Bee when I was a kid. And I kind of wish I didn't spend that much time. I wish I'd done other things with my time, but that's what I wanted to do back then. My parents didn't force me. I wanted to give it that many hours a day. And some students will spend literally like 3 to 4 hours a day on weekdays, and then even more on weekends, preparing for competitions. I sat in the living room or the kitchen of a family who was preparing for a spelling bee, and I was with them for a few hours, you know, kind of in their morning ritual of like studying words together, the mother and the daughter, while their dog was scampering around. So people give a lot of time for this, and it's a very important activity. It's a family activity, not just an individual activity. But by and large, no, they don't regret it. They look back on it with a lot of pride, recognizing the benefits it gave them. Yeah.
Were the majority of the students in these activities kind of like studying up for a competition?
I would say about half were those who were involved in competitions and studying for competitions. Another half were those who were in these after-school learning centers that are primarily focused on math but also reading. Some of these names are household names. Like, for instance, Mathnasium is one of the top 20 fastest-growing franchises in the country. I don't mean just education franchises, but any kind of franchise. It is partnering with the national PTA. So this is not just something on the periphery, right? This is more and more part of our school system and part of how schools and families understand education. So as a quick example, No Child Left Behind gave billions of dollars, federal dollars, to tutoring. And part of that went to these private companies aimed at assisting low-income students get better education and catch up to the national standards. But as these companies got the money, and obviously they grow in the process, then it's not just low-income students who take advantage of this. You know, higher-income families also do this. And that's what I studied, how an educational advantage is going to families who already have educational advantages. And one of the key things then about this, even if our schools across the country were equally funded and performing at a high level, and we were proud of that, which is obviously a far step from where we are now, but let's say we even accomplished that, which is, of course, a goal, you would still see educational inequality growing because some families have access to these educational spaces after school and others don't. That's one of the key themes here, right? That these families mean well. They're just looking out for their kids. They're not trying to hoard opportunities. And yet we're seeing educational inequality grow as a result.
It's interesting because in the book you do point out that private tutoring is now a $260 billion industry in the U.S. That's not because of the low-income kids.
Right, right. That's fast-growing. And with our current moment right now, where a lot of these kids are at home learning, right, parents have been seeking out more educational opportunities for their kids because children aren't in school that many hours a day, or they get assignments on a Monday that they finish before Friday. And so these after-school learning centers, for instance, have really upped their virtual opportunities. And so these are just going to grow. It's already a multi-billion-dollar industry that shows no sign of weakening.
Well, you point out the situation now. Did you get any chance to talk to some of these families since the COVID-19 pandemic?
Parents are concerned, right? I hear that my child has, his school has given them very little homework, and what it does give him, it's not really pushing him academically, right? We're lucky if the kids just get some academic content as opposed to more activities to do. And it's important for me to say that I'm not critiquing schools or teachers. I recognize the work that they do and the efforts they put in. But even if families like their schools, and what was ironic was that parents would say, we're in very good schools. I like my school. And even then they would criticize it and what it's providing for their child per se and why they wanted to seek out more education. And one thing I wanted to just quickly add is that when I was talking with the families, and you asked them why they're doing this, right? So is it because of lack of academic content from the schools and their heads are exploding kind of thing? And to some degree, that's the case, right? They want more academic content than the schools are providing. They want their kids to be more educated and more competitive, right, per se. But then when I started asking them what you worried would happen if you didn't do this, what do you think about families who don't do this? As opposed to why you do it, right, what you think would happen if you don't do it, parents would reveal other motivations that weren't really about academic preparedness. And it was more about having my children in this after-school learning would make them not just smarter kids, but more moral kids. My kids would be better people, not just more adept people. And so as an example, one mother said, my grandmother survived the Holocaust. My parents worked hard to put me through college. And this is why I have my child in an after-school learning center. I want them to learn these values of hard work, of survival, of commitment, of perseverance. So that, in her mind, is a line she draws between surviving the Holocaust to after-school math programs. And she's not alone in thinking that the motivation for this is not just to make our kids have more math or reading or something else, but it's about making them a certain kind of person. And this is one of the key reasons why these after-school learning practices, whether for competitions or for after-school centers or something else, are not going to stop growing. Right? There's so much meaning parents give to these beyond the academic content alone.
Your book does talk a lot about race. That's part of the discussion here. One of the stories in there that struck me was the first spelling bee, 1908, you talk about, where the winner was an African-American girl, and that was the last spelling bee for over a decade.
You're right. That was not the intended or expected outcome. And so certain places of geographies in the South, like New Orleans, decided we're not going to participate in a spelling bee anymore as a result of this. And it took over a decade for there to be the first, quote-unquote, official national spelling bee. And race does matter, right? So a lot of families I interviewed were immigrants from Asia who are very committed to this educational practice and are kind of stereotyped even as being tiger parents who are forcing their kids into this. And I show that that's not really the case. These parents can be committed to educational outcomes for their kids, but they're very sensitive to their children's wants and preferences. And it's not much different than parents who have their kids playing, you know, Little League, because the parents grew up playing Little League and want their kids to be in it and believe it's important for them. Even if the kid is, you know, somewhat interested but doesn't really care that much about softball or baseball, you know, those parents are still looking out for their kids and giving them different opportunities. And the same is true for these immigrant parents who are putting their kids in different academic settings for certain kinds of outcomes. They're doing it in a sensitive way, and it's, but yeah, you do see immigration playing a role in how this practice is growing, why it's so popular, and also some of the concerns and criticisms of it as well.
The stereotype of Asian Americans is, you know, they're all brains, they're the best students. Is that stereotype used as a club against other ethnic groups?
In fact, more than that, I could say, you're absolutely right. And more than that, it's actually used as a club against white students who are in their schools. And so you'll see this in lots of metropolitan areas where the white students are the ones who are the biggest number, right, and demographically, but there are Asian Americans in the schools. And if the Asian Americans are thought to be or seen to be doing really well, then oftentimes it's the white students who feel that we've kind of lost our place, right? We're no longer the ones on top. And you see newspaper accounts of white families who will leave school systems, leave towns, because they're seen to be too competitive, and even unhealthily so at times. You see divisions within towns as white families will say, we need to limit our homework and relax about education, and other families, Asian American families, saying, no, that's not how we should do it. We should be, you know, kids should get as much education as they can handle, and we should be pushing this. And there was, an article in the New York Times about Princeton, New Jersey, where this took place. There was articles about the Bay Area where this takes place, and I saw it in the Boston area. So it's all over the country that we're seeing immigration, ethnicity, race permeate how we understand this practice of hypereducation. But one thing to understand is that this is a growing trend, and it's national, and it's and all kinds of families are doing it. We may imagine it being pronounced among certain people, but that overlooks the fact or obscures the fact that this is a growing trend across multiple demographic groups.
Still to come, we heard how race is a factor in hypereducation. What about gender? We'll answer that one next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Pavan Dhingra, a sociologist and professor of American Studies at Amherst College. We're talking about his book called Hypereducation: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. We discuss the role that race plays in this story, but what about gender?
No, I'm glad you asked that. Gender is a really meaningful motivation for why certain families enroll their kids in this activity. So a lot of mothers in particular said, listen, I know that girls, when they hit middle school, their math scores tend to go down. Their math confidence tends to go down. And I don't want that for my daughter. I talked to a lot of mothers who said this, similar versions of this. We want our daughters to have options and confidence in life. They don't have to become mathematicians. They don't have to become engineers. None of that. But we want them to feel confident in what they can do. So we have our daughters in, for instance, a Kumon Center or some other kind of math center. Even though they're doing just fine in school, even though my fifth grader is doing just fine, because I want them to, when they hit seventh grade, hit eighth grade, hit ninth grade, to be strong enough in the subject that they won't dip in confidence. They won't dip in scores. So parents saw this as a proactive attempt to keep their daughters in particular from suffering a certain kind of possible fate that they thought would damage them down the road. And these weren't mothers who themselves were highly skilled or even committed to math. But they saw, I see this happening, I've read about it, I've heard famous people make comments about women's abilities in math and science, and I don't want that to happen to my daughter, right? And you go to math competitions and you see it's predominantly boys who dominate the competitions. So gender was quite pronounced in how families understood this and what motivated them to do it.
Neither of us are practicing psychiatrists. We both know this. But looking at the parents who do this, is this, you know, I'm going to be a success through my child, that type of thing? Like a father who never made it in baseball wants his son to be a star?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And to a minor degree, you can see that. But I would think that for the most part, what you see are parents saying, not the opposite, but I feel good about what I've been able to accomplish. I feel good that I've been able to make it into a professional job, a white-collar job, and I have a decent house in a decent suburb or district or something else. And I got to where I am through hard work and education and a commitment to putting my best effort out there. And I want to make sure my kids are able to accomplish the same. And so I'm not going to just rely on the schools to provide enough education for my kids, and I'm not going to let my kids just do activities that are quote-unquote fun, even if they have certain kinds of, you know, nice attributes they create, like playing for sports teams. There's a lot for you, right, outside of just the athletics, right? It creates teamwork. It creates discipline. It helps you learn how to bounce back from a loss. There's all these nice attributes we get from playing team sports. But these parents believed there was more to be gained, not just academically, but outside of academics, for having the kids involved in these academic activities that they thought were important so that the kids could grow up and accomplish what they themselves felt they were able to accomplish through hard work, through education, and have upward mobility, right? And they thought, you know, today, looking around at college entry, it's more competitive than it was just 10 years ago, much less 20 years ago. We want our kids to be prepared for that, whether because there's more immigrants coming into college entry, or people here are getting more applicants here in the U.S., and so it's more complicated. So we cannot take for granted that our kids will have the same outcomes unless we're proactive in this, in the same way that we, the parents, were able to have upward mobility through education and through sacrifice.
Interesting you bring up teaching teamwork and how to, you know, get over a loss. Mm-hmm. The spelling bee is on ESPN now.
That's right. Right. And that's one of the kind of the fun draws to it for the families. The parents I spoke to and the children I spoke to who involved in spelling bees would say, this is the most brutal of all sports. and they would say something like, you know, if you play basketball and you're in the NBA championship, and that's what relevant analogy, because the NBA championship is typically at the same time as the Scripps National Spelling Bee. So you're like, you're on ESPN, you're hearing them talk about the NBA championship, and then the Spelling Bee's on. And so it's a good comparison. And for the NBA championship, there's like 7 games. And so if you miss a few baskets in one game, and you have so many opportunities to compensate for that. But in the Spelling Bee, is the most brutal of sports. You miss one letter, you're out. And not just at the championship level, but, you know, from the very beginning of the Spelling Bee competitions, which happens typically in schools, right? So all these millions of kids take the Spelling Bee in the school. Then the winners go on to some regional round and then some other kind of district round, and then they finally make it to the Scripps National Spelling Bee. If you miss one letter on any of those rounds, you're out. It is a sport in the sense that it's very competitive. It's very unforgiving in terms of you mess up, you're out. It takes a lot of preparation. In fact, nowadays, the idea of kids just learning spelling on their own by looking through words and the dictionary is very quaint. It's not really how it works as much anymore. Now you have Spelling Bee coaches that are hired. It's like you would have for a physical sports team, and who train the children in how to be better prepared for Spelling Bees. And people make, you know, significant income by being coaches. And families will purchase, you know, different spelling word lists and study guides to prepare themselves for the bees. So it's very much like a sport. It's on ESPN, and the kids love it. The kids love trying to make it to ESPN and being on the show and all that comes with it. And even the math competitions, like they're called mathletes, right, as after athletes. And they jump, they run into the ballroom for the competition as if it's like a pep rally. The trophies are the same size you'd get if you won, you know, the college championship or something. So it's very much mirrored after that, intentionally so. And to some degree, that's quite fair, right? And another degree, it's, you know, more just an opportunity to make the kids feel good.
If it wasn't for spell check, I'd be functionally illiterate.
Well, I had to. I share your lack of spelling aptitude because, and it's more pronounced maybe because as part of the research, I volunteered at a local spelling bee, and I was the pronouncer for the words, and there was 2 levels. There was a junior level for like first, second, and third graders, and an upper level for like fifth, sixth, whatever, something like that. And I was the pronouncer for the senior level, for the upper level, so the words are more complicated and the stakes are higher because these are children who, if they don't, you know, if they don't make it this year, they're out because they kind of graduate out in terms of age. And so I'm in a classroom with the judges and the students and the parents in the back of the classroom, and the parents are able to petition if they think I mispronounce a word. And here I am with a bunch of words I've never heard before, don't know what they mean, not sure how to pronounce them. So I'm in the backstage before the competition on my phone with an app you can, of course, download to help you pronounce words. And I'm going through all this in total fear that I'm going to mispronounce words for these youth, and the parents are going to complain. Luckily, nothing happened. It all went by without a hitch. But if the parents had complained about how I pronounce words, I would not have, you know, begrudged them because I was not confident in how well I was able to do this. These are very challenging words.
So you do have a conclusion in the book, and we don't want to give away any spoilers, but let's do it anyway. In the end, is this good? Will this become more equal? Is it going to continue?
It is going to continue. It is not going to get more equal. And in terms of it's good or not, see, this is where I want to challenge, but at least leave it open for interpretation, in the sense that for the people who are in it, for the kids who are doing it, right, especially if they enjoy it and they get something out of it personally, then it is good, right? Why wouldn't we want children to get as much education as they can, learn as much as they can? On the surface, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's a good thing. So if it's good at the personal level, oftentimes, you know, as long as the kids don't get stressed out, as long as they don't feel it's too competitive, as long as it does not increase their anxiety to be doing more academics, then that's a good thing. But beyond the personal or family level, we're thinking of it at the broader level, there are real concerns around this, that there are going to be continuing and growing inequalities in how much kids are learning. Even if you're not involved in this, but you say you have classmates who are involved in these activities and they're learning more and more, then that raises the bar of what it means to be smart enough in your school. And so now your stress level goes up, even though you're not involved, because of the domino effect. And what we're seeing then is an education arms race that's starting at a younger and younger age that is wrapping in families that may not even want to be part of it, but they feel they have to kind of up their game and be more invested in education than they otherwise may want to be in order to keep up with those who are. And even if that's not happening in your school, right, but you know what's happening elsewhere and you're thinking about college admissions or some other kind of competitive outcome, then you may yourself may feel compelled to do this and cut down on other activities you may find more inherently interesting in order to build up your capital and your abilities to compete. So there are significant consequences broadly, even for those who are not involved, and the classic divide between the haves and have-nots is only going to widen as a result of this. And even the divide between the haves is widening. And so is it good, right? Well, in that sense, no, it's not good, right? And that's something we have to keep in mind as we think about this.
Dr. Pavan Dhingra is a sociologist and professor of American Studies at Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts. His book is called Hypereducation: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. The timeline of U.S. race relations and civil rights can be seen in the evolution of comic book heroes. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What do superheroes show us about ourselves? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Patrick Hamilton, professor of English, looks at popular culture through their stories.
Superman, the paragon of truth, justice, and the American way, speaks to what Americans most want to believe about themselves. But the do-gooder, intent on building a more equal world, simultaneously campaigned against Japanese Americans in his World War II cartoons and comic strips, making blatantly racist arguments supporting their mass incarceration. The contradictions Superman demonstrates regarding race parallel those that exist within U.S. society. Post-war liberalism encouraged Americans, on the one hand, to embrace abstract visions of equality and inclusion, while on the other, looking past structural issues that thwarted their realization. This pattern persists over time. In the civil rights era, comics such as Fantastic Four and X-Men at Marvel and Green Lantern Green Arrow at DC offered heartfelt sermons against racism, and both companies introduced numerous non-white heroes. But those sermons only moralized about racism, and non-white heroes were more often time-worn stereotypes than fully developed characters. In later decades, multiculturalism spurred a diversification of Marvel's Avengers and DC's Justice League, while also spawning teams featuring non-white majorities like Marvel's New Mutants and DC's New Guardians. Whatever the creators' good intentions, the persistence of stereotypes made these token efforts at best. Superheroes, thanks to the silver screen, permeate the American consciousness now more than ever. But the same pattern persists. In contrast to the Afrofuturist Black Panther or Thor Ragnarok's nuanced critique of imperialism, most of these films founder on the same contradictions, offering superficially inclusive conglomerations of characters that in reality relegate non-whites to secondary roles as sidekicks and supporting characters. Superheroes, like all popular culture, hold up a mirror so that we can better see ourselves. In it, we see a people that dreams of building a more inclusive society, but struggles to imagine just how to do so.
That was Patrick Hamilton of Misericordia University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.